I want to talk about trusted computing over the next probably 20, 30 minutes. It's probably a little bit longer than those 15, but please feel free to just ask in between whenever you have a question. I'm happy to adapt basically the presentation I have. So what I want to do in this talk is to give an overview of the policy and legal questions surrounding trusted computing, and I'll start with a description of what trusted computing is actually all about, and then talk about some of the issues listed here, and I will skip some for time limitations. So what is trusted computing all about? It basically started with a paper by several computer scientists in 1997, and the goal of trusted computing is, in general terms, to increase trust in the overall IT environment, in networked IT environments. And in order to achieve this goal, the idea is to provide a foundation of trust for software processes, which is based on some special hardware, on some tamper-proof hardware that is integrated into the general PC architecture, but also in the architecture of other electronic devices, such as PDAs, cell phones, and kind of all different devices that are connected to the network. Today, trusted computing is looked on by different initiatives, in particular by the Trusted Computing Group, which is a standardization group that includes over 115 members. Basically, it's a who's who of all the relevant hardware and software manufacturers. Nowadays, there are about 60 million installations of trusted computing on personal computers. So, for example, this ThinkPad, IBM ThinkPad, has a trusted computing device in it. And about 50 million shipments are expected in 2006. While trusted computing has been focusing to some extent on personal computers, it will increasingly also cover PDAs, cell phones, as I've said before, and there are actually working groups working on these kind of other electronic devices as well. Microsoft started its own trusted computing-related initiative a few years ago under the name of Palladium, and after some time they changed this to the name of Next Generation Secure Computing Base, NSCUP or NGSCB. And nowadays, they, at least for the next version of Windows, they significantly scaled back their efforts. And in Windows Vista, which is the next Windows version to be distributed, they will only include a very tiny portion of the overall grand idea of trusted computing. And there are also initiatives by Intel and AMD for providing processors which support the trusted computing infrastructure. In general terms, trusted computing offers four features, and it does this by including a chip into the general PC architecture, and you see it in the middle here, this Infineon chip, TPM 1.2. This is basically a tamper-proof device which will be integrated on the PC motherboard, and from this device on, this whole infrastructure is built. And this device offers several features, and I won't go into the technical details of that, but basically, in the end, what this infrastructure enables you to do is something called remote attestation, which I'm going to focus on quite a lot. It also enables you to do something called sealed storage, and there the idea is that cryptographically you can bind content or data, in very general terms, to particular computer platforms or even to particular states of a computer platform, so that cryptographically you can make sure that certain file is only accessed when the computer is in a certain state, when certain software programs are running or are not running on the computer. Trusted computing also enables a secure input-output, so basically there's a secure path, communication path between the computer and the mouse and the keyboard and so on. And it also builds upon something called system compartmentalization or memory curtaining, where the idea is that physically you separate memory spaces for different applications, which means that the application one, which may be a virus, is physically prevented from accessing the memory space of another application on the computer, such as the Internet Explorer. And this is also, of course, security enhancing. Two short caveats: when one talks about trusted computing and the policy implications, the problem is always that one should not mingle the implications between the enterprise and the consumer sector. Trusted computing primarily has been focusing on the enterprise sector, although it may ultimately also be very important in the consumer sector. And many of these problems I'm going to talk about are more important in the consumer sector than in the enterprise sector, and one should be careful not to make too general statements about this technology. The second thing is that when one talks about trusted computing, it's actually a set of various technologies such as TCG, NSCUP, Lagrand, and whatever. And while these overlap to some extent, these technologies are distinct. So it's kind of hard to find the right level of abstraction when one talks about trusted computing. So I want to focus on attestation a little bit, in particular on remote attestation. What this feature enables you to do is something called an integrity challenge. So if I, as a computer owner, and my computer wants to communicate with another computer over the network, the problem is always that I don't know whether this other computer is trustworthy and whether it poses any kind of security risk to my own computer if I engage into communication with the other computer. So what trusted computing allows me to do is that before I engage into this communication, I receive some trustworthy information about the state of this other computer. I receive information about what kind of hardware is installed on this computer and what kind of software is installed and running on this computer. And the way this is done is that basically the other computer, which you see here in the TPM frame, this is the Trusted Platform Module, this is a small chip which is included on this other computer, this will collect information about what kind of hardware and software is installed on this particular computer. This information will then be signed cryptographically by a privacy certification authority. This information will then be transmitted to me, which is here the remote challenger. And so I have basically information about what the TPM claims that it is running on that particular computer, and I can then compare this information with some reference values which I get from a third-party validation entity. And this, basically, the system allows me to get information about what is running on that computer, and if this information has been tampered with, I get this kind of information as well. So it can be really, I can trust that this information I get is actually a true representation of the actual state of the platform. So this is a nice feature because for the security reasons, I can assess before I engage into further communication whether I want to do this, because I can assess the security risk of what I'm doing. The problem is that this feature can also be used for anti-competitive purposes, and the standard story in this regard, the standard example, is a Microsoft example. So if Microsoft would operate a service over the network, it could use this feature to make sure that the service could only be accessed by the Microsoft Internet Explorer and not by Firefox. And so this technology basically enables you to prevent Firefox from spoofing and from pretending that Firefox is actually that Firefox is an Internet Explorer application. So in more general terms, what this technology allows you to do is that it allows you to leverage your market power in service markets into the markets for software applications. This problem has, and there are basically many other examples where you can think about this issue. The Microsoft example is just one of them. This problem has been identified pretty early, and several solutions have been proposed. Some of them are technical, and I've listed them here. I don't have time to go into that. The most well-known is probably the owner override proposal by Seth Schoen from the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And some which are, from a computer science perspective, very interesting are property-based and semantic remote attestation, where the idea is that the information that is transmitted to me as a remote challenger doesn't really identify the actual application that is running, but it only transmits certain security-related properties of that application so that I'm not able to know exactly whether it is Internet Explorer or Firefox that is running. I only get the information that this particular application has fulfilled certain security standards. All of these proposals have their advantages and disadvantages and limitations. From the legal side, people have also proposed several solutions. The first was to think about this as a basic, a general problem of antitrust law, that this is basic, that this could amount to kind of a misuse of this technology, and then you should just apply general antitrust law to that. The second approach proposed by Ross Anderson from Cambridge was to use basically contractual licensing schemes, to use technology licenses as a tool to prevent the licensees from using the technology in this way, which you see in other DRM-related contexts, actually. The Trusted Computing Group itself has chosen a different path. They created a best practices committee and created some best practices guidelines. And these guidelines, you will see the statement that the use of trusted computing for these kind of purposes, for anti-competitive purposes, is actually a misuse of the technology and is not welcomed by the Trusted Computing Group. I mean, the nice thing about this is that all the member companies could agree on that. The not-so-nice thing, of course, is that this is not an enforceable means of regulation. What is interesting in this regard is that it's just an application of the idea of how law and technology as regulatory tools interact, and to think about what the limitations of technology as a regulatory tool are and where the law should step in. And there hasn't been a whole lot of discussion about comparing these different ways to solve the problem and perhaps combining them and so on, because it's technically very challenging, and so there are quite a lot of stumbling blocks in order to get this discussion running. I want to secondly talk a little bit about open source software in the context of attestation. If one imagines a network environment that is suffused by trusted computing, which is ultimately the goal of trusted computing, it is interesting to speculate how open source software could operate in this context. And the problem is that if an open source software runs in this context, it will have to interoperate with the remote attestation feature. The remote attestation will only work if the open source software will receive from some kind of entity these reference values, which I described before, that are issued from validation entities, which are basically hash values over the binary of the open source software. And now the question, of course, is who will provide these kind of certifications, these kind of reference values, PCR values, for open source software, because they may be costly to generate, there are management issues involved, and so on. One solution may be that the open source software developers may be able to certify themselves, so basically to provide their own validation entity and to do that by themselves, but then, of course, the question is whether people will trust this validation entity. Also, the problem is that traditionally, open source software has been changed quite a lot because a lot of people are collaborating on the development of open source software. This could mean that each time the binary code of a particular open source software is changed, it would have to be recertified. And, of course, this is also a financial issue. I mean, who would actually pay for that? While there have been some discussions on how one should accommodate open source software within such an environment, there haven't been actually a whole lot of solutions proposed. There are some people working on that, but it's still a pretty early area. And it really depends on how all this works out, but if trusted computing becomes standard technology, which it actually could, then this could be a major problem for open source software. I'll skip that. In general terms, what I think is important in the context of open source software in the context of trusted computing is to think about the surrounding infrastructure. And I want to exemplify this a little bit. I want to describe how this trust establishment actually works. So here we have the trusted platform module, which is this particular chip that is integrated into the PC architecture. And if the PC is turned on, then what is actually happening is that the CRTM, which is the core root for trust measurement, which is another device that is included, it starts operation, it measures its own integrity, and then stores information about this integrity inside the TPM in a trustworthy manner. It then measures the integrity of the BIOS, of the BIOS, and if this BIOS is in a trustworthy state, it will store this information in the TPM as well and will hand over control to the BIOS. Then the BIOS starts, the BIOS runs, it will then check the integrity of the operating system loader, store this information in the TPM, and then pass on control to the operating system loader, and so on and so on. So basically what you get is that the CRTM starts, and the information about the state of all these different applications and hardware devices is stored inside the trusted platform module in a trustworthy manner, and therefore a chain of trust is established, which starts from the TPM and the CRTM. The nice thing about this is that ultimately you don't have to trust that your software application is actually running in a secure state. You only have to trust that the TPM and the CRTM are secure and trustworthy, because then what they will tell you can also be trusted. So basically what trusted computing is doing is that it reduces the number of devices you have to trust in your computing architecture. Of course, this only shifts the problem, because I don't have to trust the software application anymore, but I have to trust the TPM and the CRTM that they haven't been tampered with and so on. So why should I trust them? Well, the answer by the trusted computing group is that there is a public specification of the TCG out there, which basically specifies what the TPM and the CRTM are doing. And there are several certification entities which will vouch for the fact that an individual, a particular TPM and CRTM, are in accordance with the TCG specification. So as long as you trust that this TCG specification, which is out there for public review, is trustworthy and is actually doing what it's claimed to do, and as long as you trust these kind of certification entities, then you can basically trust your own computer and the whole network. So what trusted computing ultimately is doing is that it's transforming social trust in entities into trust in technical components. All the more it becomes important, of course, to think about how these entities are actually designed. And that's one of the problems of the trusted computing debate, that the technological debates focus basically on how this technology should be architected and so on, but they don't focus on the question how the surrounding infrastructure should actually be implemented and who should operate it, who should operate these kind of entities, whether there should be competition between entities, or what the dangers of centralization is, and so on. Just some general remarks on trust in this regard. There has been a huge amount of literature on trust from the law, but also other areas of social sciences. And in this application, it may be most interesting to think about trust as a tool to reduce complexity. So today we are surrounded by an IT infrastructure where a vast amount of users are actually unable to really understand what's going on, both inside the computer and also on the network. So they cannot really assess the security risk of their behavior and so on. Introducing kind of a trust infrastructure in that is a tool to reduce the complexity of the network, because you don't have to understand exactly what's going on. You just have to rely on certain trust relationships. And that's what trusted computing in this regard seems to try to do. Then, of course, the problem is whom should we trust, or whom do we have to trust in this kind of architecture? The philosophy of the TCG, of the trusted computing group, is that anybody may assume authority to certify, and TCG feels credibility may be found among many organizations ranging from product manufacturers, vendors, consumers, and consultants. The product owner ultimately decides which certifier best contributes to assurance and risk management calculations. So the idea is that ultimately, it's the consumer who will decide whom he wants to trust, because there will be competition between different entities that compete for the trust of the consumer. While this is a nice idea and it may actually work in some circumstances, the problem is, of course, that this competition may be impeded by market failures, in particular by information asymmetries, network effects, and so on. So it's questionable whether ultimately there will be several entities that will compete for these trusting services that are provided to users. In this general discussion about trusted computing is an interesting application, because it's one of the few applications where you're forced to design trust relationships from scratch. I mean, you're just designing a system and try to define where trust relationships in which direction should go. And it's also interesting because it forces you to really formalize these trust relationships in a very strict manner, because they have to be coded into software and hardware. A few words on autonomy. The proponents of trusted computing, when one talks about them with about these policy problems, they usually say, well, you know, it's actually not a problem, because the user is able to turn on the trusted computing functionality and turn it off. And by default, it's actually turned off. So it's the decision of the user to use trusted computing or not. So it's kind of an opt-in technology. Well, the problem may be that in reality, this may be just a myth. Because if you think about a future where a lot of applications and services rely on trusted computing functionality, so you have to use trusted computing in order to send an email, then of course the notion that it's your free decision to turn on trusted computing is kind of a weak one. So I think in order to get along with the discussion, it's just more realistic to some extent just accept that the opt-in argument is a myth, and that we may be faced with a technology that will just exist, and that we have to cope with the adverse effects of it in other manner than just by saying it's an opt-in technology. A second thing which is also relevant in this respect is that the trusted computing group distinguishes between the owner and the user of the platform. And this comes from the corporate context, where the owner is basically the company and the user is the employee. And under this kind of understanding, trusted computing, the components should be under the owner's full control. So it's not the user who has the autonomy, it's the owner, which may make full sense in the corporate context. The problem is that the definition what an owner and a user is may be blurry in some contexts. And the example here is for cellular networks. There have been some discussions whether a mobile network operator is actually the owner of the mobile phone, and the end user is just the user of the phone, which would mean in this context that that the user doesn't have any kind of autonomy to decide what he wants to do with his cell phone, but it's the network operator who does this. And this argument has something to it, because the more you're talking about branding cell phones and binding cell phones to particular to particular networks, the more it seems like an idea described here. I won't talk about sealed storage and the competition-related features, because they are basically very similar to the attestation. And a recent example is actually the attempt by Apple to bind the Intel-based Apple computer and the Intel-based operating system, OS X, to the Intel-based Apple computer. And they, at least right now in the prototypes, they use trusted computing in order to achieve that. And I won't talk about APIs just for time limitations. I want to say a little bit about privacy, though. Every trusted platform module includes a so-called endorsement key, which is a cryptographic key that is used for a lot of different purposes inside this architecture. The problem is that this could also be used as a unique identifier for each personal computer, but probably also for just persons identifying to be identified through that. Of course, this is problematic for privacy reasons, and the industry and Trust Computing Group has recognized this right from the outset, because it resembles quite a lot the debate a few years ago about the Intel Pentium 3 personal identifier, which they plan to include in the Pentium chip. So the Trusted Computing Group has come up with two solutions to that. The first one was to rely on privacy certification authorities. The idea there is that if I want to communicate over the network with this kind of architecture, I won't identify myself via this endorsement key, but I will use a certificate from a privacy CA and use this kind of certificate. And this will enable me to use the network at least pseudonymously, which is a nice thing. The problem with this feature is, again, it's kind of an application of this surrounding infrastructure problem. This only works if the privacy CA is trustworthy. So if the privacy CA colludes with others, or if it just publishes some information about me, then this whole privacy protection breaks down. After this criticism had been raised, the Trusted Computing Group came up with another proposal, an alternative, which they call direct anonymous attestation, which is basically an approach similar to a zero-knowledge protocol. It's not a total zero-knowledge protocol, but it's similar to that. And the idea there is that I can basically communicate with another user over the network without the involvement of any third party, and I don't have to reveal any kind of personal information to the other party, but there is some zero-knowledge proof that I'm actually the person I'm claiming to be. The problem... So Trusted Computing Group was faced with one problem. If you think about DRM in this context, you have to have a feature to revoke certain users from the network, because if somebody breaks the security, copies songs and passes them around, then you want to exclude him. So it couldn't be a fully anonymous system. So they included a feature which enabled them to revoke devices that have been manipulated. The problem is that there has to be someone who decides actually which devices to revoke. And what they are basically relying on is that there is some notion of a blacklist that is out there, and this blacklist will then be scanned, and all these devices that are listed on the blacklist will be excluded from trusted computing. The problem is that in no document there is any kind of information how this blacklist will actually be assembled, who will have control over this blacklist, whether it's a decentralized or a centralized blacklist, and so on, whether there's kind of an appeal process or whatever. So it's just, again, the same problem that the surrounding infrastructure is not really defined within trusted computing. And one of the reasons is that just getting this technology running is so complex. It's really very, very complex, much more complex than DRM technology, actually, that people are just focusing on that stuff and not on these issues. A few words on copyright, although I don't want to focus a whole lot on that, because personally I don't think that that the focus of the trusted computing debate is DRM. So there have been some discussions whether trusted computing can serve as a basis for digital rights management systems. And there are some technical arguments why this actually may not be the best foundation for it, and I won't go into detail of that. Let's just assume that trusted computing can actually serve as a basis for DRM. If you then think about the features enabled by trusted computing, it actually seems that there is nothing too new under the sun. What it enables, for example, is that it enables you to bind objects to particular platforms and platform states, as I said before. Well, this you can observe also outside of trusted computing. There's a standard called CPRM and CPPM, Content Protection for Recordable and Pre-Recorded Media, which is, for example, used in audio DVDs. And this also enables you to bind content to particular devices, to particular CDs or DVDs. If you talk about software compartmentalization, you see this to some extent also in software-based DRM systems. So what trusted computing is doing in this regard is that it raises the level of security that is provided to DRM, but it doesn't seem to raise a whole lot of new, qualitatively new policy problems. It just makes the general DRM-related policy problems more prevalent. What is kind of interesting to talk about is the relationship between trusted computing and anti-circumvention regulations. Because if you think about trusted computing, if I want to analyze the security of a particular platform, what I can now do, I can just analyze what's going on in that platform. Under a trusted computing idea, it may be that I'm not enabled to do this because there is some tamper-proof device and I have to circumvent the device, and the circumvention itself may be a violation of the DMCA or similar provisions in other countries. And so there could be a shift from kind of a paradigm where you have a security by proof, where you can actually prove what's going on in this kind of architecture, to a security by trust, where you basically just have to rely on a third party that vouches that this kind of particular platform is in a secure state or not. Trusted computing and the GPL versus 3 is also an issue that has been discussed a little bit, because there were some news that Richard Stallman and Edmund Moklin thought about introducing a clause into the GPL version 3 that would prevent the interoperation between trusted computing and open source. Now, in the first draft in section 3, there's only a provision on DRM and open source. So it's, again, doesn't seem to be a particular problem of trusted computing. The last thing I want to mention is the idea of a paternalistic IT design. And this is kind of the idea is to apply the behavioral law and economics discussions about paternalism to this particular aspect of IT security. So as I've said before, what trusted computing allows you to do is that it provides the computer B, me, trustworthy information. The computer B provides trustworthy information to both a third party and also to the user of the computer B itself. This is a nice thing for security purposes. The bad thing is that B loses some control over his computer because there's this tamper-proof device which he cannot manipulate. If the computer B is compromised, in general, this creates security risk both for third parties and for B itself. Now, the standard answer for these risks created for third parties would be, let's create a liability regime for the user of the computer B, because then he would be liable for these negative externalities created for third parties, and then he would just prevent this damage from occurring, and so this would be a nice thing. Or you could think about other parties subject to the liability regime. There has been a recent paper by Doug Glickman and Eric Posner about whether ISPs should actually be liable for these kind of actions. The problem with this kind of approach may be that it's maybe very hard to actually identify where a particular security risk originated in a network, because the viruses may not reveal where they originated from and so on. It becomes even more problematic for the owner of the computer B itself. So if I, as the owner, install a certain software, which may be a virus, then this does not only harm third parties, but also me and my computer itself. So the standard answer there could be, let's just have an information disclosure regime where you will inform the user B about the risks of what he's doing, and then he will take this into consideration and then not install the software. The counterargument there is that there may be deviations from the standard rational choice model, like over-optimism, overconfidence, availability heuristic, and so on, where basically people, even if they are fully informed, will not act totally fully rational and will not actually not install the virus or so on. Then one answer could be, you should have some debiasing strategy and try to reframe the story so that people will actually be able to process this information properly. This could be problematic, because we are talking about a very diverse and global population, and it seems hard to find a kind of a story in which you can put the users in that will work. If one agrees to this, then basically another answer could be just a mandatory technology design, where you basically prevent technological people from running into certain security risks, because there doesn't seem to be another answer to this problem. And that's one of the ways to think about trusted computing. It's just prevents you from running into risk which you are not able to actually foresee in its fullest extent. The problem with this discussion, and that's a general problem of the behavioral law and economics discussion about paternalism, is that the behavioral studies on these deviations are basically descriptive. It's a descriptive theory about how humans behave, and it's kind of questionable whether from this you can derive some normative conclusions that there should be some paternalistic institutional design. The second problem is that there may be a tension between paternalistic regulation and innovation, and this is kind of the von Hippel idea from MIT here about user-driven innovation, that if you have a architecture that prevents users from doing whatever they want to do with the kind of architecture, this may have be detrimental effects because there may be innovation that the producer of a device is not able to foresee and that only users are able to do. And with this kind of paternalistic design, you may actually prevent some innovation from occurring. So to conclude, in general, I think a lot of trusted computing it's a story about the centralization and decentralization of control. Who will control certain entities that are important in this kind of context? It's important to think about these issues actually now, because what we are talking about is a very pervasive technology. It may end up, nobody knows it, but it may end up as technology that will be included in basically every electronic device that is connected to the network. And what is interesting to think about in the future is to think about the surrounding infrastructure, what I've talked a little bit about, to accept that opt-in is often a myth, to conceptualize trust, what really trust relationships in these contexts mean, to think about whether trusted computing can actually be based upon a very open architecture, whether it can be based on open source software. There's actually a huge project funded by the European Commission that just started, where the idea is whether you could build all this stuff on open source software. And to think about to what extent value-centered and, in particular, paternalistic technology design is achievable and something that is desirable. Thank you very much.
So in your last slide, you mentioned that this is really a story about centralization of control, and it seems that as a technologist, it seems to me that this technology of trusted computing and digital rights management in general can potentially be quite useful in being able to make attestations, as you say, about whether a particular computer or device is performing the operations that its owner actually wants. However, it seems that there is an equivocation as you mentioned, between the owner, the actual owner of the device, and the creator of the platform. There is this contention for who is actually eligible to speak for this device. And it seems that this technology can really be decoupled. We can have, for example, technology that actually enables the owner to say, I believe that this is a set of parameters in which I want my device to operate, as opposed to simply handing it off to, say, Microsoft or Sony or some third party. And you mentioned some possibilities, like with the EFF suggestions of owner override, for example. Is there a general promise? I mean, can you comment on whether you think that these sorts of approaches might actually be the solution to separating centralization of control issues from the security issues?
So I think they're, in the mid and long term, they may be very promising. The problem is that, I mean, even inside the trusted computing group, there have been lots of discussions about these issues. The problem with these technological solutions seems to be that some have really drawbacks. Sometimes they don't work, or sometimes they don't work in certain instances. So, for example, the owner override, people have argued that for a whole lot of applications, in particular DRM, it will not work. And so it's not a valid solution, perhaps. But there may be other solutions like the property-based and semantic remote attestation, which are actually very interesting to look at. The problem there seems to be, from my understanding, that we are just not at the point of just the pure research where we have a solution that can be implemented on a wide scale, because they will only work under certain circumstances. They are based on Java-based virtual machines, and so they will only work for a certain set of applications and so on. So you have basically restrictions currently that prevent you from implementing this on a wide scale. However, it's pretty recent research. It's about research about like last 2 years or so. It's just not mature. So my personal hunch is that in the long term, it could actually solve quite a lot of problems. That has been my opinion also in the DRM debate, that it could be that a lot of the policy problems, at least to a certain level, could actually be solved on the technological level, and therefore we don't have to think about some weird legal structures that try to achieve the same goal. But it's definitely a long-term thing.
First, I just have to admit that I'm quite ignorant of this and learning quite a lot from your presentation, and I find it terrifying. And I'm just wondering, trying to understand engineering first, in terms of the hashing the application binary, that process, this happens at application launch, with any application launched, and then it raises, I think we're getting up with all these issues about, you know, Java apps and dynamic libraries, et cetera, et cetera. I'm sure maybe we're just even getting at this, that there's some range of technical issues that need to be resolved. The other thing is, I just want to make sure I understand this, in terms of the policy, this is sort of an affirmative approach where you have a set of OK apps, and if it's unknown to you, then it's not OK. Is that essentially the approach that's being taken?
So on the first question, how this hashing works, so basically the hash is taken at the point when the software is run the first time, or basically when it's started, when it's executed. It's not that every 5 seconds a new hash is taken. It could work like this, but the general idea right now is that it's just when it's launched. And the idea originally was also that basically a hash of every kind of software application that is launched will be combined into one large hash, so that you basically have one hash over the whole software and hardware that is running on the platform. And this raises some problems about how you calculate this hash, and it also raises the problem that in the end you have gazillions of variations of this hash, and nobody really knows what this all means, because you want to compare this kind of hash to some reference values, and if you have gazillions of variations, then it becomes probably just not workable. So that's one of the problems they try to deal with. And there have been also criticisms raised that they say, well, you know, the software application may be secure when it's launched, but it may change, and when you're talking about Java and dynamic libraries and so on. These, to some extent, have been criticisms. To some extent, they have been dealt with in the architecture. And the second, the policy? What was that?
Well, I kept thinking of this word innovation, which this seems like, you know, innovation's sort of enclosing technology in the extreme. So what I, on the policy side, I was just trying to make sure I understood it. In general, what you would do is, it's this affirmative thing. If you're on the apps, then you're trusted. If you ain't on the list, that may mean you're unknown, but we treat you as untrusted.
So the Trusted Computing Group from the outset has been very clear that what they don't want to have is kind of a white and a black list, so kind of approved applications that will run and will not run. And there have been quite a lot of confusion, because people assume that that's what actually trusted computing is all about. That's not what trusted computing is all about. Trusted computing, just what they say, is that they provide you with an architecture where you will get these kind of PCR values, these integrity hashes, this integrity measurement hashes, and what you will do with this kind of information totally depends upon you. So you just get this information, and then you can decide by yourself whether you think that this platform is in a secure state or not. This, of course, doesn't really solve the problem, because actually it may evolve into a state where you actually have kind of blacklists and whitelists that are offered by some kind of service and so on. And the answer by the trusted computing advocates is always, well, you know, this is just beyond our specification. It may be that it evolves like this, but it may not be. It just may be in a very decentralized manner, and people will decide by themselves.
Guns don't kill people. People kill people.
Yeah. And, I mean, to some extent, there. Yeah, well, it's hard to. It's very hard actually to argue against this, because every time a policy question is raised against trusted computing, trusted computing guys will just say, well, you know, this is just beyond of the scope of what we're doing. So, well.
Can I ask you a question on the anti-competitive point, which is sort of twofold. One is how one would deal with it in terms of this difference between the problem that I assume that if Microsoft, to use your example, wish to shut out Firefox, they would not be so blatant as to say we're just shutting out Firefox. They would say, Firefox has a behavior that we consider insecure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then this would be rather like their moves with Java. And so there's certainly the question of how do you police that type mm-hmm. of security decision?
Mm-hmm.
And a secondary question, even in the sort of the semantic remote attribution where you were revealing presumably lower level indications, how do you prevent the workaround that is it doesn't take Microsoft very long to map some unique combination of these to understand that this set of semantics actually defines the fact that there's a Firefox browser operating.
Right. Yeah. So the first point is about the problem that you can, of course, always hide you can basically publicly state that it's a security reason why you shut off Firefox, and behind this you can hide other arguments. And this is an argument which was also used in the Microsoft proceedings, in the antitrust proceedings. If you look at the consent decree, there is basically a statement where Microsoft is required to license certain APIs and so on to competitors, but it is entitled to refuse this licensing if, for security purposes, if it wants to protect DRM and so on. There's this, a clause in the consent decree. And the court addressed, of course, the question, well, you know, who will define what security means? And this is basically the same problem. And the court there said, well, you know, it's hard to say this in abstract, and we have to look at the particular instances, and it's just, it doesn't seem such a big problem that the whole clause is invalid or whatever. So basically, this is an unsolved problem, and one has to look very carefully. And so this is one of the reasons why, to some extent, I like the semantic remote attestation and property-based attestation a little bit more. The problem, of course, is that even then, you could imagine kind of the definitions of certain properties that would identify certain applications or would shut off certain applications from this area. And so I think the only solution to this may be that the level of abstraction or the kind of properties that can be defined and derived through this kind of mechanism should be defined in a manner that this is not possible, and I'm not totally sure about whether and to what extent this would actually work. It may be that ultimately you could actually misuse the whole remote the semantic attestation idea in just a way to identify particular persons, and I haven't seen a discussion of that topic and to where someone really thought this through whether that's actually possible, because currently, basically, these are two or three papers out there, and they define how this semantic and property-based remote attestation would work. They don't define the particular properties that could be identified or that should be identified in this kind of context.
Yeah. So, Bernard Guterman over at HP basically predicted that 5 or 10 years from now, at least in the enterprise space, there will be no more PCs. That will be dumb clients and dumb terminals and smart servers. And there are lots of incentives to move consumer electronics that direct to industrial and solve most security issues. What does a TCM-based regime offer that, once it's fully equipped and enabled, to stop all of the social ills that you were talking about? What can you still get out of a TCM regime that you couldn't get from a stupid terminal? A world where everyone just has a stupid terminal and a smart server.
Well, so if all these problems would be solved, then the only thing which trust computing would add to a PC would be a certain level of security. Apart from that, a certain higher level of security. Apart from that, in an ideal TC world, you could basically just use the computer as you could do it now, with the only exception that perhaps for some stuff you would have to have some certification from somewhere, but this wouldn't be used in any kind of anti-competitive way or whatever. So it wouldn't be a dumb terminal at all. It would be a fully operational personal computer, with the only difference that there would be an infrastructure where trust relationships could be built upon.
It seems to me that we touched very briefly on this, that it's not just the service side, it's also the software side approach too, which is sort of restricting competitiveness. That essentially, if we have a world in which it is very easy to produce software that users can install without too much trouble, then it is very easy for malicious actors to dupe people into installing malicious software to undermine the stack. And if you sort of make it very difficult, then you've shut out large swaths of the software.
Yeah, but I mean, then it comes down to the question to what extent you really solve the policy problems. I mean, when you say that, so this example, when you say that it should be very easy for users to develop software in this kind of remote attestation context, this would mean that it should be very easy to either get a certificate from a validation entity or to operate your own validation entity. And then the problem would be that the virus developer could also get very easily such a certificate, or he could also develop a validation entity by his own. The answer by trusted computing would be, well, you know, if it's a third-party validation entity, then they will have some standards and they will look at the software thoroughly and
it's working out really well in the certificate authority world right now. And so compared to the world right now, so if you take this as the way things are set and set up now, we can't even get good certificate authorities, let alone having certificate authorities balance other aspects.
So the question is whether this kind of validation entity idea would actually work. And if you talk about the validation entities to be operated by the developer himself, which is also thinkable under this kind of architecture, then the trust computing answer would be, well, you know, people will just develop kind of an idea whether they can trust this particular kind of validation entity, and there may be third-party information services which will provide you with information that you shouldn't trust this kind of validation entity. The problem, I mean, it's kind of a speculation whether all this would work or not. And the problem is that, I mean, if you talk to people developing these kind of issues, I mean, I've been talking a lot on these validation entities. Trust computing people sometimes tell, well, you know, even the definition of the validation entity is outside of the scope of our specification. So right now, trusted computing, they don't really care about where you get these reference values from. It may be kind of a validation entity. They may be written down that you may just calculate them yourself or whatever. So it's kind of hard to speculate about the implications of all this because nobody knows really how architecture would look like.
So instead, if I can keep the floor for a second, the process you keep talking about how, so you told us a story about the developers. I'm very ignorant of the development process. There are no potential certificate stakeholders, CA. Stakeholders involved in the development at all?
You mean in the development of trusted computing?
Standards development. It makes sort of, you know,
So
it makes sense that these people, current CAs, would have a very large role in such.
So VeriSign, for example, is a major player in trusted computing, in the trusted computing group. But, I mean, they may be a large player, but the official answer you get from trusted computing people is that there will be competition between whatever. I mean, I'm not. It may turn out totally differently, and it may turn out that basically there will be VeriSign and they will certify everything, or whatever, they will be the only player in this field. But nobody knows really. The problem is also that basically there are about six different logical entities that will issue certificates in this kind of sphere, and whether they will be actually different entities in the real world and how they will interact and so on is also another question. So, and all this is basically one has to wait until some kind of prototype implementation or implementations out there to see actually who is operating this and stuff like that. And you won't get a whole lot of information what the trust computing group envisions, because they will just say, well, you know, let's wait and see, and this is not the goal of the trusted computing group, it's the goal of the individual members, and it's outside the scope of our specification. And so I think it's a very interesting thing to think about, but it's and one could think about designing the infrastructure in a way that some of the problems can be solved, but I don't see a lot of work actually in this area.
It seems to me that what you had said before about the neutrality of these technologies, it seems like there's really no ethically neutral or no morally neutral technology. It's like we can't say that there's a technology that does not promote the idea of some particular Western values or some particular oppressive regime, etc., because they do. But it seems that in response to your comment, the crux here is that we're going to need to provide a means by which the owners can actually execute, can actually exert control over the system, the owners of the actual systems. If I write a program and I want to get my friends to be able to run it, I want some means by which they can say, this is a program that I'm getting from my friend Jeff, and I'm going to run it now, and I trust it. And provided that they have that kind of certification authority themselves, the owners of the individual machines, it seems that that a lot of the problems could, in theory, go away. I guess the question remains as to how they would evolve socially, though. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I also think that a lot of the problems could actually be solved if you have kind of a really decentralized model of these validation entities or other certification authorities, where in the extreme you could just operate your own validation entity. And that has been one of the proposals for open source, that basically, well, you know, they just will, or Apache or some kind of recognized or the Free Software Foundation institution will provide these kind of services. And I think that would actually be a very good thing. The problem, again, is that nobody knows whether it will develop like this. And you can, of course, make theoretical predictions about whether this is likely to happen or not. But still, it's basically too early to tell because nobody has really implemented this. And, I mean, nobody has there's no validation entity out there, and therefore not a single open source program has been used for that.
I just would respond quickly, which is that one of the problems sits in your very solution, which is that you say the owners take these decisions, but if I understood the presentation, the owners are not the users. And even a benign owner, such as Harvard University, that only means well for all of its users, still those decisions would probably be made by the system admin staff in the office of IT something something, whose, you know, cover their, you know, bottoms approach is let's be really cautious about what we allow. And those are the owners.
Right.
And you,
well,
said
I used
owners,
the word owners, but I meant
but
the
you
word
meant
users.
Users,
yes.
But the approach, as you detailed it for us, is the owners get to make the decisions, and probably in the end, the owners would.
They distinguish between owner and user, but they don't really define what this is, and this may be totally different in context. So perhaps the future will lie that you have to fight for the right to be the owner of your computer, not only the user.
And perhaps you could be your owner of your computer in your home, but not in your office in certain circumstances.
So this is sort of taking a step back, and it's probably very ill-informed and perhaps impossible to answer. But just thinking about my day-to-day travails with my various computers and how things sometimes function and sometimes don't function so well, what sort of problem would that pose to a system that's based on complete integrity of all your applications and all your functioning, when, as best I can tell, never is my machine or my cell phone or anything functioning at 100% capacity. So wouldn't you always, I mean, just from a very buggy perspective, it seems like everything would be insecure or untrusted.
I mean, the grand idea of trusted computing was really to have all this working perfectly, and then, I mean, that's the way they designed it. The amount of complexity that is added upon the general PC and network architecture is actually very, very high because it's a pretty complex system. And so one can, with good reason, speculate whether this will just be another kind of complexity that will not lead to any real-life increase of security. One of the issues, I mean, one of the ways to resolve this problem could be, and nobody knows, but it could be that trusted computing will not be used on a grand scale for every kind of application, but will be used for very narrow, specified areas. So you could talk about banking applications, high security applications, or about, I mean, the idea, for example, in the NSCAP world of Microsoft was to have a system compartmentalization where you would have, there were these famous slides where you have the left side of the computer, which was totally unsecure, it was just normal Windows side, and there was the right side where certain applications would run in this trusted mode. So the idea in all these kind of areas is to modularize the areas where you really use trusted computing and thereby to get rid of a huge overflow of complexity. And so this may be where the solution lies. But it's kind of hard to imagine that all this will work perfectly in 2 years. I mean, that's for sure.
So what are some implementation scenarios? So if you say we've got the vision of things working perfectly, we've got a vision of things not working, which is kind of status quo with an extra chip in our computer, what is partially implemented? And so what are some of the forces and incentives going on if we have sort of a partially rolled out GPU system?
So I think there would be application-specific. So the health sector might be interested in combination with smart cards. The cell phone industry might be implemented in, or the banking industry. So this would be basically first probably implementations which would, to some extent, rely on non-PCs, on other kind of devices which are easier to control because they're not as open from an architecture point of view as personal computers. And in the PC world, it would definitely first start in the corporate context, because in the corporate context, you have a much more limited amount of software applications and diversity of applications that is running, and there's normally a sysadmin who's able to control what is running and what you can install and stuff like that. So there, it's just much easier to control what is going on in your network and in your computer. And these are probably the areas where it would start, and whether it really goes on to the consumer context and covers everything probably depends a lot on the development over the next few years, whether it's actually workable and stuff like that. I mean, Microsoft has stepped back a lot, and they scaled their efforts quite a lot down because, to some extent, of compatibility problems, but also because of complexity problems, and nobody really knows what they will do in the next version of Windows and stuff like that. And of course, it depends a lot, the development of this technology, and whether Microsoft will implement it or not, because it's just the player in the consumer context.
I have a question about the often in this kind of lunch group, we tend to assume that if a person is giving a presentation on a topic, they're advocating that. I don't think that's what you're doing. I was wondering if you wouldn't mind giving one or two tips on what you think we should be watching as we see this evolve. Like, what should we be looking out for?
So it's kind of true that I'm not advocating this in a particular way. I'm interested in this because it's kind of an interesting application of the attempt to think about value-centered technology design, whether you can actually solve some of the policy problems at a technological level. And that's why I'm interested in this kind of topic. That's also why I'm interested in DRM, actually. And so I think the things to look for are probably attempts by technologists to address some of these policy problems and to develop solutions, or at least to think about solutions similar to this semantic remote attestation and so on, that try to alleviate some of the problems, and so that basically the lawyers don't have to step in the end. And I think there's a lot a lot of opportunity to work in this area and to think about this. And ultimately, it may not work. I mean, nobody knows really whether that's a workable approach. But my impression in this context and also in the DRM context is that a lot of technologists are kind of reluctant to engage in this kind of work because it gets murky. It requires quite a lot of interaction with policy people, legal scholars, and so on. And so it's kind of it's not a regular path how a lot of computer scientists do their research. And I think it's a challenging area there and could be interesting. And I'm not sure whether it will actually, in the end, help. But it's just interesting to watch.
Well, I think we should wrap up and let everyone go off to do their business. But I hope Stefan and his father will stick around for anyone who wants to chat with them a little bit further.
Sure.
But please join me in thanking them.
Thank you.